Some things in life seem like they need no explanation. Like, people need clean water to drink and clean air to breathe. And both are essential for a healthy and safe environment. But what if everyone doesn't agree on that basic premise? And it appears that's a real question here in Oregon. State Senator Jeff Golden has proposed a joint resolution that seeks to change the state constitution to legally mandate a clean, healthy, and safe environment for all Oregonians. Joining the exchange to tell us why we need to change the state constitution is State Senator Jeff Golden. Welcome, Senator.
Well, hello, Mike. It's good to be with you.
Well, we're all just trying to keep up with the daily deluge of news from D.C. What's happening in Salem?
Oh, another deluge that's somewhat related in that so much of our business and so much of our funding and other things are interlinked with the federal government. So we're living with the same uncertainty everybody else is, sort of an extra layer on our work. And then there's just plenty of, you know, Oregon-based issues that are pretty urgent right now. I think you want to talk about Senate Joint Resolution 28.
Well, we can start there and we can go wherever you want.
Okay, wherever I want. Okay, not enough time to talk about. Senate Joint SJR 28 would refer to the voters an amendment to the Oregon State Constitution. The Oregon State Constitution only gets amended by a vote of the people. The legislature can't do that. So this would be sometimes called the Green Amendment or Environmental Rights Amendment. It's been adopted already by three other states, a couple of them many years ago, and is under debate right now in a number of other state legislatures. And basically, the basic idea is to establish a right. There are a lot of rights in our Constitution, federal and state. This would establish a right of Oregonians and future generations. I'll read just a couple sentences. You'd amend the Constitution with a section that says all people, including children and future generations, have the fundamental right to a clean, safe, and healthy environment. The state shall protect and restore this right equitably for all people, giving the highest priority to the safety and health of children and future generations. That's the gist of it. And as I say, it has been established in other places. And, you know, we have rights for property rights, all kinds of things. And somehow not this in our Constitution. And I am one of a growing number of people who believe we haven't done a terrific job of trying to leave a better world and a livable world to future generations. We've been a little too wrapped up in other things, including our own consumption habits. And, you know, I'm of a generation, you might be too, where our parents really made a lot of their decisions based on what was going to be best for us. We were blessed with that. And that's somewhere along the way, it's kind of gotten lost. And so this provides some protection that comes to bear when states are considering certain regulation or allowing certain practices. I can offer one example if you'd like, but that's the gist of it. State government, our governments, while we're protecting other rights, should be paying more attention to the what the environment's going to be like, especially for our kids and their kids.
Well, it reminds me of how many Native tribes approach decision-making and looking 7 generations down the line. And you mentioned that this is under debate. Well, who's against our kids having a clean, safe, and healthy environment?
Nobody. Nobody says, I hate that idea. I don't want my kids to have a safe environment. What the opposition would say, this is open the door for, I probably won't do them justice, but I understand they'd be saying, this opens the door to all kinds of litigation and all kinds of ability to stop projects we depend on. And, you know, Oregon is hostile to business, and this is going to make us more hostile to business and drive business out of the state. And, you know, it's sort of airy-fairy, and, you know, who knows, we'll spend years and billions of dollars in the courts. And that's the kind of thing. It's not realistic. It's too vague, that kind of thing.
Okay, so what I just heard you say if we can assume that's what the opposition will say, is that it's rooted in land development and wealth creation.
Would you ask that again?
What I heard you say, the opposition might say, seems to me that their argument is rooted in land development and wealth creation.
Well, that would be, maybe that could be one way of putting it. There is the first state that to adopt this, and the language is a little different in different states, was Pennsylvania. And I want to say it was decades ago. I don't know exactly how long. And the impetus of it was a lot of concern, as I understand, for pollution of farmlands and waterways from different kinds of industrial projects. I think, you know, some of the heavy industrial, it was heavy industry coming against, agricultural Pennsylvania. And the people rose up and demanded something like this. So, you know, some of the issues I imagine were about water quality and what was going into creeks and streams, pollution of agricultural land from different kinds of things. So if you put that underneath the category you just suggested, then you're right. But it could take in a number of different environmental issues.
Well, that does make sense, because when we look at commercial land development and industry, there's an impact. Impact on the air. There's an impact on the water. And if we just trust it to the developers, to the commercial landlords, if you will, we get what we get. And what we have gotten, what we have inherited, is insufficient. And it's unsustainable, as I understand your argument to be.
That's my view on things. I totally agree with it. And it is easy to make this all about corporations, and there's a lot of corporate practices that I think need to stop or be tempered. But we need to look in the mirror, too, because that activity happens because of our collective consumption habits. You know, we want fast, we want convenient, we want cheap, and that is what makes the way for the kind of environmentally negative practices that we're talking about. So, you know, there's some lifestyle choices, some kind of social choices probably we're all going to have to make if we're serious about passing on a livable planet to our kids and grandkids.
So we're all in this together. My guest is Oregon State Senator Jeff Golden. He sponsored a bill that asks for a ballot measure that could change the state constitution to include environmental protections for all Oregonians. So, Senator, I know you're busy in Salem trying to change our state constitution, and you may not have noticed the slow train wreck in D.C. that crashed into the U.S. Constitution. It seems that there's an unanswered question about whether people in positions of high power can be held accountable by constitutional law. So if you're successful in changing the constitutional law for the benefit of all of our people here in Oregon and future generations, how can you ensure enforcement?
Well, I'm guessing you wouldn't have asked that question 2 or 3 months ago, because we are seeing a spectacle where, you know, I'm not a pundit on national affairs, but this is bringing to the fore whether a single individual who's president of the United States is going to be able to ignore constitutional law and other kinds of law. It looks to me, not an attorney, as if constitutional law is being broached right now. And the big question on everybody's mind is who stops, and traditionally would be the courts. There is some question about the court's ability to operate independently of the president right now, which is what we've read about in many other countries that have not had the institutional strength that we have. Well, now that's up right now. You know, I'm fairly confident that if we pass this and there'd be litigation and there might be disagreement in the courts about whether this amendment would apply to a certain project, say a certain industrial project, but that it wouldn't be just roundly ignored like it didn't exist. but that, you know, the whole, everything we thought we knew about government is kind of up in the air right now.
It really is. And I think my eyebrows went up when people just started willy-nilly ignoring court subpoenas. And Congress just kind of ignored that. And so here we are. Here in Oregon, I don't think we've reached that level. If your joint resolution passes, what happens next? Walk me through the steps and the timetable.
Well, there would be a tool. Let me give you an example. I'll ground it in something that actually happened in Montana. You may have heard of Our Children's Trust, which came out of the University of Oregon, I'm going to say 12 years ago or something. And it was some attorneys who organized 20 children, I think at the time the ages were like 5 to 20 years old, to be plaintiffs in a suit that said the state of Oregon, through allowing certain projects, neglecting certain principles, was endangering their right to a healthy environment, basically their right to have a life, live a lifespan, that kind of thing. And it had a little bit of success in the early legal stages and then was tossed out. About 3 or 4 years ago, Our Children's Trust made the same kind of suit in the state of Montana. And while it's not all the way through the courts, it's been succeeding because Montana has constitutional language like this. So basically, their attorneys were able to make the case that, well, you're violating the Constitution when you don't make any response to climate change in a meaningful way, a constitutional rights being violated, and the courts found that to be the case. So what I would expect is that there might be some testing of the law, but I don't think, over time, I don't think we'd be seeing this avalanche of lawsuits. I think the more likely effect is that having that law on the books and maybe seeing a lawsuit or two would have state agencies looking at applications for all kinds of things around effluent into rivers, around dredging projects on rivers, you know, around forest practices that might change the center of gravity on what is and isn't permitted in Oregon.
So this becomes a legal framework to hold people accountable.
Yes, and it's more about putting a stronger sideboard on environmental protection in what government does and doesn't decide to permit, in mostly industrial projects, than it is about, you know, triggering the big waves of lawsuits.
So what can people do to help the progress of Joint Resolution 28?
I want to refer them to an organization. It's a very interesting organization, about 2 years old. It's a coalition of several dozen environmental groups and citizen groups. It's called OCERA, which stands for Oregon Coalition for an Environmental Rights Amendment. So that's OCERA. And people can Google that and find their webpage, find out more details about the reason behind all this, and find out how to get involved if they choose to.
Okay, well, we'll put a link on our website connected to this conversation. What else is on your legislative agenda that we should be paying attention to?
Wildfire. There's a big effort to fund it. You know, the general fund can no longer pay for what we need for wildfire. So, you know, we have these enormous bills to suppress wildfire. And we look for all the nickels and dimes and under the cushions to pay for it. We pay for it. What's getting really shortchanged are prevention programs, help for communities to get readier for wildfire, to reduce the risk, you know, all the evacuation problems, all of that we are shamefully neglecting because of all the other demands on the general fund. So there's been this long conversation about how we're going to pay for wildfire, and we're going to see some proposals on that. I am very actively propounding an approach that would take the next income tax kicker, which right now is estimated to be $1.8 billion, and turn it into a permanent wildfire trust fund where you'd never touch the principal, but the interest generated, which at, say, 5%, would be $180 million every biennium would all be spent on wildfire programs. That's controversial. Some people don't think we should take the kicker. But what people need to know is that there's no free pass. Wildfire is going to cost all of us more in the future than it has in the past. And that's just a hard reality that politicians don't like to talk about.
Well, that's a big issue. But unfortunately, we're out of time for today's exchange. Thank you, Senator.
I appreciate the time, Mike. Take care.